Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Hi, Burl.
Hello, Sherry.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Today's special guest, we're going to talk a little bit about sports today. Our special guest today is Bill Baker. He is an architect by trade, but he is the managing partner of MSA Design, a local architectural design firm here that really does a lot of sports facilities, indoor practice facilities. And I had the opportunity to talk to him for a story related to the reforming of the Sports Commission in Cincinnati to bring events here. He's part of that effort. He's on the old one. And we got to talking and I was like, he's so interesting.
That makes
the best guests.
And if people don't know who Bill Baker is by the time this podcast is over, they will, but they already know his work.
Yes.
So we'll hopefully get into that and let him explain some of the things he's involved with. But yeah, he is, I would say, in the news because of this Sports Authority effort. So we can talk about, you know, what that is targeting. And we all know what that is. Let's bring the business of sports to Cincinnati.
That's right.
All right. Well, speaking of making Cincinnati a...
Cincinnati.
Yes, you know, putting it in front of people's minds as a cool place to be. You and I were on assignment together.
We were.
That hasn't happened for a long time. Actually, I wasn't on assignment. I just wanted to witness what was going on. But
we went to the unveiling of the brand Cincy Hub, which is like a one-stop shopping for anything that a business, a person, anyone who wants to put together something about Cincinnati can find assets at this website. Pictures, images, data.
And I was having trouble wrapping my mind when I saw the press release and the invitation. Okay, like what is this actually for? Like who would use this? And the panel, one of the panels that they had were people who were recruiters. And suddenly the light bulb turned on like, okay. We recruit here. My wife happens to be a recruiter for Children's Hospital. And when you're trying to sell, you know, someone on a job, you're also trying to sell them on the city, the community. Like, why would you want to live here? Why would you want to work here? Raise your family here? What are the things to do? And I have at times gone to different websites, cut and pasted links, pulled stuff together, you know. They've done that all. They have wrapped it up in a package and a bow on top. Like, here's what you need to sell the city if that's something that you're involved in.
They being Cincinnati Experience, which is kind of like tourism. That's their main job, is to market Cincinnati kind of to the outside world. But Visit Cincy, the Chamber, the business community, a lot of people are involved in this effort and putting it together. The funny thing was, you kind of get the email and everything, and they're like, you know, we're really talking about branding the city. And I'm like, what's the slogan? They're like, we knew you were going to ask that. There's no slogan.
No stinking slogan. It's not that.
That's very hard to do. And everybody knows it. And it's not that kind of branding. It's more what we have to offer and pushing it out. And one of the main things I will say that I do like about it, it is for these businesses and recruiters. But anybody can use this. It has materials that a real person can use to be like, hey, I'm planning an itinerary. I'm having out of town guests. It's my wedding and I'm going to have a lot of people in. And so you just go to its brand Cincy Hub on the internet.
I think it's just brandcincy.com.
And you have to put your email in, but then you can kind of see everything that's there. And so it's for real people too. So I kind of, it's a story for actually Inquirer readers. I really liked that aspect of it.
Yeah. Anybody can go there. You just have to register. You just have to give them your email address and, you know, create the, you know, for what most people will be like the 900th password they have to remember. Sherry, do you have like one password you use for everything, or do you have different passwords for all the websites you?
I have different passwords. I try and keep up with changing them all the time. It's so hard.
I do not do good cybersecurity.
You can't. Why are you telling the world this? I try and be good. The password to my phone.
I mean, my passwords are complicated. It's not like my passwords are, you know, password 123, whatever.
As part of the Inquirer, the passwords to our phone have to be very complicated.
Oh, they have to change regularly. But
you have to put the password in your phone on the regular. Like, you're not just like sitting down at your computer.
You don't use the facial recognition to unlock your phone?
But every, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 times, which I'm on my phone all day long, they're like, actually use your password.
Actually use your password.
And then you have to, like, toggle back and forth to all the different things. It's so annoying. But it's safe, so that's okay.
So that's really the only hurdle that you have to go over to get access to this website. They have beautiful photos, you know, of downtown, the suspension bridge, you know, the stadiums lit up at night. So if you just, you know, if you're in the need of, you know, those assets, those like marketing branding assets, you know, it's not just for recruiters. It's anybody that is, you know, trying to, you know, like we said, sell the city, promote the city, sell somebody on the city. You have a one-stop place where someone has put a lot of thought into putting these assets together. So that was interesting, and they had a pretty good turnout there. We were at that co-working space.
Co-Hatch at Findlay Market. There's Co-Hatches all over. It was a lovely space, though.
Yeah, the Co-Hatch at Findlay Market is cool, right on the corner there by the market. I actually took the streetcar home, Sherry.
I saw. Yeah. I was on the streetcar this week.
Yeah. I just walked over the Race Street, hopped on, jumped off at Fountain Square, walked the rest of the way to work. I actually used it as a commuter instead of like a weekend.
You did do that.
Novelty. Yeah. It was fine. There were people on it.
Lunchtime. You were at lunch. It was lunchtime.
It's been a while since we talked about the streetcar.
Yes.
I'm a fan.
Well, I think we might get into that a little bit later, but
yeah, that would be good to get into.
I have some thoughts about where I want it to go.
I guess I am a fan.
I want it to be more useful than it is
maybe
now.
Maybe our guest has some thoughts on where
so,
it should go.
So, you know, I'm like, go big or go home. So let's expand it.
All right. Well, should we bring on Bill Baker?
Yes. Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm super excited to welcome Bill Baker from MSA Design today, and we're going to talk all things sports.
Bill who?
Bill Baker. You know what? You might not know the name, but you certainly know the work.
Which is the point I was trying to make.
Yes.
No disrespect, but like, why should people know Bill Baker? We're going to get into that today.
Yes.
Well, it's glad to be here. Love your guys' work. Appreciate all you do for the city and the region, and happy to have a conversation.
And while you are the managing partner of the company, I've been kind of referring to you when I've been talking about this podcast as the wind beneath the wings of all of our sports teams here. Because could they do anything that they do without a good practice facility, which your company builds? No, they couldn't.
No, yeah, we're blessed to be a hometown firm. And as we talk, I give all props to our CEO, my partner, Mike Schuster, who founded us 40 years ago. And in the mid-90s, his advocacy for the Riverfront versus Broadway Commons really was the genesis of our sports practice. And that led to some relationships with the Reds, who've been great to us over the years. And then one project led after another. And then about 2 years ago, we were looking at some rankings and realized all of a sudden we're top 10% sports architecture practice in America right here in Cincinnati. And so we're grateful to have great local clients, regional clients, and national clients.
We have so much talent here. We mentioned earlier in the podcast about the brand hub Cincy and all the things that we have to tout. And that's really true. We have a lot of talent here.
We do. It's a great city and a great place to do business and live and raise families.
You did take me back, Broadway Commons.
Yes.
If things were built at Broadway Commons, we would be a much different city today.
It would be.
We would. And as Mike will be proud to say, it wouldn't have fit. So we got the best bang for the buck. And the great spot, the best place for the ballpark, I think, is on our riverfront, along with, as we're looking here at Paycor Stadium, we have two great anchors and an amazing redeveloped riverfront.
You know, we really do. And when you sit inside the stadiums, they're situated. So we could say whatever, like the Bengals, they need this or that or the other. Like there's a lot of conversation about that. But it's situated so beautiful that the span that you would look through is you're looking at the Roebling Bridge. And when you're in Great American Ballpark, these days you look at Great American Tower and you the skyline. And it's just absolutely stunning when you're inside the stadium and not looking at the field.
I mean, I think those generational investments that leadership 25, 30 years ago and continues to develop and obviously expand as we build out the banks and the riverfront. I mean, it is one of the most beautiful riverfronts in America, and I would say it's in the world. And so we're blessed to have those two sports anchors, as along with another sports tenant down beyond Great American, you know, the arena, having all those activities on the riverfront, plus parkland, the mixed use, the connection to downtown. I mean, it's a win-win for all of us.
And just to fill in some of the gaps for our listeners, if they don't remember what Broadway Commons was, that referred to the area where the casino is now, roughly. And that was in play when we decided as a the greater community that Riverfront Stadium, which was then Synergy Field, which was the multi-use baseball slash football stadium, no longer fit the needs. We were going to construct a standalone baseball stadium, and there was an effort to get it built north of the riverfront. And there were pros and cons to something like that. Wherever a baseball stadium goes tends to spark development. In hindsight, what do you think would have, what do you think the riverfront would have looked like had we not had it, in your words, anchored by the two stadiums we have right now?
I think that's a, I don't know what
that
question is.
It's like a fork in the road, honestly. Yeah.
I think it really was. And I think you needed those two major civic investments on each end. And certainly, I defer to Mike and others who are integrally involved in that. I was earlier in my career. But I think having those two big anchors along with the parking decks and bringing out of the floodplain and then the park investment, I mean, it's just magical. I mean, you can't, you go around the country and I can't think of another city that, especially an inland city, that has this kind of a coastline on a river. That, you know, most of them are more industrial. There are tons of highways, but we have this amazing riverfront. Now that Northern Kentucky is doing some further investment, and they're going to be sparking some things over there in Covington, I think it's a great complement to downtown Cincinnati.
So let's talk a little bit about your work. So I think at the moment, there is a, we have a series here. It's called Going Up. Like there's so much things going up, but we try and answer a lot of questions about like, if people are like, well, what is that? And I know people are really starting to see a big project of yours, which is the indoor practice facility at UC.
Yeah. The indoor practice facility and athlete performance center at the University of Cincinnati is awesome. It's, for those who don't know, it's in the southeast gateway of campus, right along Jefferson Avenue. It's the site of the old Shakely Athletic Center, which was the temporary bubble, and then the practice facility, and then the outdoor practice facility. And it's really a world-class facility, and we're the lead architects on the team. And it is partnered with some national folks and a ton of other consultants, as you can imagine, a project that large. But it's going to be a great home for the Bearcats, and it's, I would say, top-tier Power 5 indoor training facility, and only for their football. Who will be a primary tenant, but for all their other student athletes. There's some dining, there's certainly recovery and other amenities to it. And UC has done a tremendous investment in their donors and John Cunningham and the athletics department and President Pinto and everybody else supporting that program. And it really elevates them and vaults them into the midst of the Big 12 conversation with facilities. You couple that, Fifth Third Arena, obviously Nippert Stadium, which is unlike anything in college football. I mean, they have a world-class athletics campus now, really right in the heart of the city, which, you know, the difference with UC, you know, I'm a Columbus kid. I grew up in Columbus. You know, places like Ohio State are sprawled, right? You have athletics over here. You have the core campus over here. But UC has this dense square mile where you now have world-class athletic facilities for the student athletes right in the heart of campus. And architecturally, it's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be a great gateway. It's a statement, as in other buildings on UC's campus and their identity. And so we're pretty excited to see that underway. Those who drive by, you'll see, I think, the latest truss for the indoor practice facility structure just put in place. So you can see the scope and scale and the size of it if you drive up right by campus.
Tell us, how indoor these practice facilities at college campuses have mm-hmm. changed, because we're in like the era of name, image, likeness and trying to get the best athletes.
Yeah.
And certainly I would have to think that the players are looking at that type of thing when they're trying to decide. I mean, obviously they're looking at their education first, but they might also want to see where they're practicing.
It's changing, as you know. It's an interesting, and we talk about this. I have friends and you know, we talk about this internally, and I have friends who are architects, obviously, all over the country. Some who are involved in college sports specifically, like we're heavily involved in college sports. It is interesting. 10, 12, 13 years ago, the facilities were pretty much, it was who can build the best and brightest, the shiny toy, right, to bring the athletes. I think now it's a different conversation. There's a certain level of competency, and you have to have a basic level of amenity, a really nice facility, world class, which obviously they have. But part of it is the NIL package that some of the elite athletes are being offered. And so it's interesting. Certainly at UC at Big 12, that is a different conversation. We do a lot of other work with some MAC schools. We've done work with Miami, OU, Ball State's an active client. And there it's a different level. You know, a lot of those are just trying to have great quality facilities. They don't need to be the shiniest tool in the shed, but they need to be nice in a certain basic level. Yeah, but certainly UC's elevates them to a new level and puts them on par with everybody in their conference, which is important. And then the NIL conversation, I leave that to the smart people. You know, that's above and beyond the architectural side.
What kind of things does an indoor, what does the practice facility need to have?
Well, certainly you have the field or the, depending on the sport, right? The field or the court, whatever the play is. So there we'll have a world-class indoor field that matches the quality and type of Nippert, you know, the outdoor field. Covering, they can do some level of kicking indoors. They have an adjacent practice half field right outside that was already in place. So they'll be able to go indoor and outdoor for certain activities. But you have to have strength and conditioning rooms. You have to have athletic training, hydrotherapy, certainly world-class locker rooms. You're going to have coaches' offices. You're going to have meeting rooms. Dining and nutrition is huge in those facilities, whether it's at UC or like work we've done for FC Cincinnati and Mercy Health Training Center. The dining and nutrition part is everything, because as you know, these are world-class high-performance athletes. There's an incredible level of management of their diet as part of their training regimen. So making sure you have world-class dining facilities for that aspect of the coaching staff. And then offices and meeting areas. And then wow factor. There's always wow factor because, you know, you're bringing in teenagers to these facilities and you're trying to wow them to come to these universities for the education, for the NIL package, for the quality of the program. And so it's really one key, I would say, pivot point or key foundational point for all college athletics is to have great quality, beautiful facilities that are well functionally laid out, that organize well. Yeah, they look great, they're cool, but they also have to function really well. And that's a big part of our practice. And Mike has stressed that from day one, and we stress it with all our leaders, that these have to be organizationally sound and designed around the path of the athlete and the coaches so that it's easy to workable, easily move around, you know, during their practice. It's seamless as far as point A to point B. So you have to organize and design these really around the function and flow. And then you can wrap the architecture and the vision and the graphics and all the cool stuff around it, but it has to functionally work first.
When is it set to open?
2025. And I will let the, I will defer to the University of Cincinnati for the final
of the
opening
date. Yeah, of the ribbon cutting.
Our partners at Messer Construction are doing a great job as always. The team there, Brian Borcherding and the entire team and Nick Rosie, and they're doing a great job. And so they're a great local company headquartered in Cincinnati that does world-class construction work. So I can't mention that project without giving them a great shout out for the work
they do. Built a lot of things around here, TQL Stadium among them.
Yeah. Well, I can attest to the wow factor. I attended not one, but two graduations at UC.
Uh-huh.
And first of all, you had to kind of circumnavigate the construction site just to get into. Well, that's okay. I mean, they did a great job. They had golf carts running and things like that. Yeah. But the wow factor is already there, and it's not even finished yet just because of the scale of it. You can tell it's going to be.
Yeah.
You said it, you know, joining the already unique architecture that you see at UC. I know Sherry wants to dig into all the things that you're involved in that are making news lately. But since this is the That's So Cincinnati podcast, we do need to get into the origin story of Bill Baker a little bit just to learn.
Oh, you don't want to know about that.
Oh, yeah. What got you into architecture?
So I'm a Columbus area kid. Sorry, Cincinnatians. I did not go to high school here. So people ask me, where'd you go to school? I usually say Ball State, but I've learned now. I went to Sparta Highland. Grew up outside of Columbus, was debating what to do. And I saw this is going to sound really nerdy. In October of 1989, it was my senior year of high school, I saw a Nova episode called Design Wars. and I had thought about architecture as a choice, and you know, I was a teenager, didn't know what I was doing. And it was on the design competition for the Chicago Public Library. And they profiled like five firms that were world-class architects. And I remember watching that show, and in 1 hour I said, that's what I'm gonna do with my life. And literally I made that decision. Who knew? You know, Channel 34 Columbus, WOSU.
You wouldn't have a lot of like choice. You didn't have a lot of television choices then. And
four.
Like, if you, right? And then, and so you, like, that is something that we all watch.
I am always envious of people who have that eureka moment. Like, this is my destiny. Because I'm the kind of person who just, as Yogi Berra said, I got to the fork in the road and I took it. You just kind of like see where life takes you, kind of thing. And I had, you know, ideas and things like that. But that's interesting. So did you come to Cincinnati to join MSA? Is that what brought you
here?
Well,
yeah, it's funny. I went to Ball State, met my wife, who's also an architect, proud Ball State Cardinal, Mid-America Maction. We moved away to North Carolina. We got married right after school. Moved away to North Carolina, and then after 4 years, we decided we wanted to come home. My folks are in Columbus. Her folks are in Evansville. So we said, what's halfway between? Cincinnati. And so I called a college professor, a dear mentor of mine who's retired, Tony Costello, and I said, Tony, do you know anybody in Cincinnati? Because this is really before, this is early internet. This is late 90s, right?
It's not like you could just fire up LinkedIn. And
Yeah. And he said, you know, there's this guy, Mike Schuster. He's a friend of mine. I think you guys would get along well. He goes, you're a little difficult. He's pretty passionate. I think you guys would get along well. You should call him. And so I called Mike and came up and interviewed with a couple different firms, but it was clear. And so that was the path I knew. So 1999, I came on board the firm. It's been a great ride. We're an amazing practice. We have 80 people between all of our offices. Headquartered, obviously, about 70 here in Cincinnati is the core of our practice. Our sports practice is essentially based here. We have some expertise in Columbus as well. But it's just been an amazing run. And we do a lot of other things besides sports, but a little over half of our work now is sports. So whether it's pro baseball, you know, the great local team, Cincinnati Reds, Houston Astros, the Marlins. We have a great new project that's just started in Daytona Beach. It's the Jackie Robinson Ballpark renovation.
Wow.
Which is incredible because most people do not realize March 17th, 1946 was the actual date that Jackie Robinson integrated professional baseball in Daytona Beach. He was in the minor league. It was in spring training.
So it seems like there's an anniversary coming up.
Yeah. And so on Jackie Robinson Day, I love that the Tortugas are an amazing client. City of Daytona Beach is amazing. On Jackie Robinson Day, everybody wears 42 except for the Daytona Tortugas who wear number 9, which is what he was wearing when he played the first game in Daytona Beach. And so we're doing a $25, $30 million renovation expansion of the ballpark. It's a new player development facility. It's improvements to the historic 1935 original ballpark. That's a pretty exciting project, not only because just it's fun, it's minor league baseball, but for what it means in the context of society, that was the place that began the change in baseball that has, you know, transformed the world, to be honest.
What is the first, if you can remember, major project you worked on in Cincinnati that people might know?
So this is going back to 2000, 2001. We had been doing work with the Reds as a design advisor. We were not the architects in the ballpark. We were hired by the Reds to advise them while the county was building it. And so we began to build that relationship. Mm-hmm. And Mike was integrally involved with that, along with my other partner, Keith Hall. The first sports project I worked on was there were two big ones at the same time. It was Schuller Field at Mount St. Joseph University, the on-campus stadium. And Balaban Field at St. Xavier High School. So I understand and so doing those, that was in 2000, 2001 was my first foray into sports practice and projects. And then it really just snowballed. I began to do some more work for high schools. We did Cincinnati Public Schools work. We did Walnut Hills. We did work at West High. We did work at Taft, some work at Withrow. And then it just spawned into college work, Miami University. We began to work on Jaeger Stadium, the renovation, if you remember, about 20 years ago now, the East reconstruction. And then it's just blown up step by step. And so it's amazing. We have work, obviously, in Texas. We have work in, I'm trying to think, Puerto Rico now. We're working on a gymnasium facility out in Puerto Rico. We have work in Pennsylvania. We've done some work, planning work in some MLS stadiums out east. Can't say which ones. Obviously, FC Cincinnati is a wonderful client to us. The Cincinnati Reds have been a great client to us. And University of Cincinnati. So it's just really blown up, and we just continue to have fun. And what's done is it's attracted talent. We now have people, when we apply for a job, coming from all over the country. And so my friends in the sports architecture world get mad. I jokingly say this because the Sports Architecture Center is Kansas City, has been for 50 years because of Arrowhead Stadium, and there's a whole story, and there's some stuff on the coast. But I always say, why can't Cincinnati and Ohio be the center of American sports architecture? It's a pretty awesome town. So why can't we do it here?
Why not? So I have to ask, you recently became a managing partner.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still get to do architecture? Or are you now just leadership and management?
I think we are architects as a species, and I can speak to other architects and other practices. Some in your building, I know this is a small town. We all know each other. I still get to do some architecture, not as much as I used to. And that's okay, because my job is to help, obviously work closely with Mike, our CEO, design leader, design and strategy, our founder, and continue to build the culture of our firm and empower the people in our office to do great work, whatever kind of work it is. But I do get to keep my hand in a few projects from time to time, which I enjoy. There's probably 2 to 3 projects that I'm able to be involved with on a regular basis. They're usually larger. But it's just fun to see what our people can do and get to do, and to watch people grow, watch people who were interns. We're very blessed to have a lot of retention, which is not common in our industry. There's a lot of churn in architecture and design. We have a lot of people who I remember when I first started were college interns who are now principals in the firm running major projects. And so it's really cool to see how we're growing and evolving. And then the city has been, in the region, has been tremendously gracious to us. So we're very grateful for all the people who trust us to design their projects.
So I hear passion in your voice, which mm-hmm. is something I love about when you can have passion about your job. I think mm-hmm. it just is life changing.
It's everything.
When you look back at the Nova episode mm-hmm. and all of the excitement you kind of saw with the building of the library, is your job like what you watched on TV?
You know, it can be. Architecture never, no day is ever the same. Ever.
Our jobs.
Yes, it's the same for journalism.
I think so. And, you know, what I tell people too is they don't realize is typically, and I tell our young staff this, when people come to us to help design, we don't build, we design, and we work with great building partners, a lot of great contractors in town and in the region. People come to us and they're usually trusting us with the largest capital expenditure their organization, their company, their institution, their family will ever do. And so we have to be gracious stewards and be honest and open and great advisors to make sure we leverage their dollars and design something that meets their needs functionally, is beautiful, wonderful, you know, improves the communities in which we serve. We don't want to do bad buildings, right? We want to do great facilities that improve the urban fabric. But also in the end, there's nothing better. And this happened recently. We had an opening for Athletes in Action's John Wooden Fieldhouse up in Xenia. And I got to go to the ribbon cutting. There's a special day for an architect when you walk in a building that's done and they have the ribbon cutting and everybody's having the punch and cookies, or, you know, there's the speeches, but you get to sit back and watch them take it away from you, which is awesome. It's like, I mean, I'm a parent. My kids have not left the nest, but it's somewhat what I think the feeling I will have when my kids leave the house, go on to college, move away. But there is and it's a bittersweet moment. And I always love to, I've done this. I wasn't able to do it on Athletes in Action. I typically like to go to the building the day before, or the site or the stadium, whatever we're doing, the day before it's open, do a site visit and just walk in by myself and walk around and kind of think about the team and the people who've been a part of it. You know, the dozens of people on our end, the dozens of people from a client, the hundreds of people from the contractor side, and just kind of walk through and realize the collective effort it took to do it. Because it's not an easy job. It can be tense at times, especially when you're doing a significant amount of money and things you don't see underground or things don't quite fit together right, which is normal. It's a lot about managing people and working with people and building trust. And so it's a joyous profession. I'm blessed. I'm very lucky I got the direction at that age, because I would have probably wandered for a long time through Mid-American Conference School. I mean, I had a great time, go Ball State, but I had some level of focus to keep me tempered and get me through. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's just a great industry, and this city really appreciates, and this region appreciates good design. And so it is a blessing that we're able to practice here and all the institutions.
And they're not afraid to call it out when they see it, when they see bad design,
or
design
that
doesn't live up to the tradition of architecture we have here.
And there's a phrase, I give a lot of credit to.
Did I say that? I'm just quoting people.
Yeah, you are today.
I'm just going to move past that comment. But, you know, I credit, you know, Mike often, he has this talk. And as a design, we are first and foremost a design firm. That's our mantra. Whether we're doing sports stadiums, whether we're doing Calhoun Hall at UC, you know, academic buildings at Xavier, Indian Hill Schools, we're first and foremost a design firm. So whatever we do, we want to make sure that it's beautiful and adds to the fabric. Sometimes the budget doesn't give you much to work with. Even he has this phrase, I mean, he laughs about it, but there's some truth to it. And we talk about this with our young staff. Sometimes all you can afford is a blue wall. All you can afford is the paint to make an accent wall cool in a space that doesn't have a... So do it. Try to find the design moments. You know, don't look at the budget you're given as a limit. Given that that's your budget, what are the opportunities to meet the needs, but also give the project some design flair to give it some uniqueness, to give it some character that reflects the client, the site, and the place. Whether it's a blue wall, whether it's we did at Mercy Health Training Center for FC Cincinnati, we have some cool canopy elements that help define the statement of the building. Whether it's University of Cincinnati, you'll see there's a form, and as the shell goes up, you'll be able to see the form of the indoor really gives it some character, because those buildings are especially hard because they're usually giant, for lack of a better term, barns. And so giving those, using architecture to give them some detail, but within the available budget, is always a challenge. So that's, I mean, trying to be good designers no matter what we do, even if it's an indoor renovation or a new building or a renovation, outdoor renovation, is just leave a positive legacy wherever we go. So 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, when many of us are gone, people will come back and say that we were involved in those buildings. And I want my kids to, when I'm long gone, say, you know, my dad worked on that project back when he practiced, you know, 40, 50 years ago. I think that's important for us. So we have that blessing as architects to have that opportunity.
Should we jump into the Sports Commission?
Yes, the Sports Authority.
It's going to be amazing.
So that we had an opportunity to talk about it because there's a Sports Authority here now. It's a little bit dormant. There's a whole effort now by Visit Cincy with some city investment to bring back the Sports Authority.
Yeah, and I
bring
think
it, big events here, and you're advising on this and going to be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, the Sports Commission, which we had before, which I was a part of, was really focused on youth sports, and, you know, it was a smaller organization. And it did good for what it could do. And obviously it went dormant and during the pandemic. But I think the new vision that Visit Cincy, you know, the CVB or Visit Cincy, I still forget the new name from time to time, but the Visit Cincy and obviously the CBC, you know, Gary Lundgren, Julie Calvert, and their leadership is trying to truly invigorate a sports commission that will get us local, regional, national, international events that will allow us to showcase our city, bring economic opportunity for our city and for our businesses, but also showcase what we have to offer. I mean, we have a world-class city, and we've proven we can bring in the All-Star Game. We've proven we can bring in world-class events, and with the convention center investment, with all the other investments on the riverfront and the other kinds of facilities, we should be able to bring in some of these national sporting events, you know, more NCAA tournaments, you know, events, more championships, more, you know, semi-pro or professional level kinds of things. The NFL draft, why can't we have these things here? So this group will be charged and now really looking at a bigger national, larger picture. I think a lot of the genesis came through the World Cup bid, which we weren't successful, but a lot of relationships were formed through that. And a can-do spirit, which we know Cincinnati has. And we realized we can do this. And so let's put an and they've obviously been leading on this, putting infrastructure in place to make sure that we'll have the proper entity to properly sell, plan, manage, and bring those kinds of events to the region. Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky, Indiana, all of it, this whole.
I mean, it could be up and running like the end of summer, or beginning of fall.
I know that they're actively pursuing putting the structure in place and getting involved in the next steps. So I'm excited. I think it's going to be great for the region. I think it's going to be nothing but a value add to greater Cincinnati and the region. And some events may be big enough that it trickles into Lexington and Dayton and Columbus. And, you know, I go back, you think Nick Veer, almost 20 some years ago with the Olympics work that he did, I think began to show Cincinnati, we can be a national, international place. And so some of that inspiration, and Nick was part of the World Cup effort, and he's a fantastic visionary for the city. some of that effort went into the World Cup. And then we said, you know, we can do this. And then this idea, and obviously CVB and CBC is really leading the effort to put it together. But I think it's going to be awesome. And it will be a great thing for the region, not only the city, the county, but the neighboring states as well.
When you look back to the idea that since, because of course the Summer Olympics is coming up, mm-hmm. that we made a bid for that. Mm-hmm. What do you think in hindsight of that? Like, were we thinking too big or... No. Is that the way we need to be to eventually do something like that? You have to start somewhere.
You got to think big. I think I'm off as a Columbus kid who is always amazed at what's happened to Columbus since, you know, I graduated high school and left. A deep connection to the city. We have a branch up there in our practice and still do some work there. But I think Cincinnati should dream bigger. I think many folks from Cincinnati don't realize what we truly have. And I think there are a lot of people like me who are maybe from the region or moved here and have seen the transformation over the past 20 years, which has been unbelievable. Why not go world class? I mean, I travel around for business in other parts of the country. I put Cincinnati against many cities, especially of our size and of our, you know, metropolitan size. I'd put us at the top in the country.
So should we bring up the question of the arena?
Absolutely. Well, you don't actually design arenas. I did hear we're in the midst of an arena study. Yeah, right, about that. About once a month, I think. Yeah. Because
here's how I would ask this question. And you know, if you and I are just, we're out having a beer. Mm-hmm. And I know your background. I know your passion. And I ask you over a beer. If you were king of Cincinnati mm-hmm. for a day, king of Cincinnati and Hamilton County for a day.
Ask me that question. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Sherry, what's your answer?
How would you dictate what should be done to replace the arena? Where should it go and who should pay for it? How to get it done?
Yes, that's some of that's above my pay grade.
No, I'm promoting you. You're the king.
I will defer payment. You know, that's a
that's the hardest question of this whole thing.
How do you pay for an arena is a whole other thing. And obviously, you know, Sherry, I know Brendan's told you we're part of the just early stages of the feasibility study about the arena. I think
headed by the chamber, Brendan Cole, friend of the podcast.
Brendan and his leadership and their board are doing great work. I think Heritage Bank has, you know, serve the city well. It does a lot of great events. It was built in the early 70s. I think it's about as old as I am. It's about 50 years old, maybe a little older. It for modern amenities, for what shows and events, it obviously has some challenges. And there's nothing wrong with it as far as it was built at a time when arenas were done differently. And so there's been a desire to have a new modern arena in the city. As for who pays for it, how that's, you know, I'm going to defer. That's way above my pay grade. I'm just an architect.
Because, all right, you're right. You're not the budget person here.
Yeah.
But you do understand about space. Mm-hmm. Is it better to build an arena? Let's say that we're going to do it. Is mm-hmm. it better to build one there or somewhere else? Is there enough space to build a modern arena where it is right now?
I mean, I think we had, as you know, we did some studies 10, 11 years ago.
In my guest room right now.
A conceptual study that showed that something could be developed on the current site in that area. So certainly there's room for it. There's a lot of places that it could go, you know, whether it's inner city, suburban, you know, certainly there's a lot of places to go. I think from an urban planning perspective, and I'll put that hat on my, as an urban, you know, somebody who loves, I live in the city, my kids go to Cincinnati Public Schools. I mean, we're here to stay. I think getting it in the urban core is important. Where possible, if ultimately it doesn't go there, then so be it. I think having it in our amazing walkable downtown, obviously not in the heart on top of Fountain Square, because we have, you know, one of our biggest challenges as a city is when it was platted out, we have very small blocks from a city's perspective, whereas Columbus is bigger. But it's hard to, you know, slide an arena in two city blocks, right? Because of the dimensions of our blocks are a little small. But I think wherever it goes, being around or adjacent to the urban core, I think would be a strong approach. Whether it's at the current site, at another site, to be determined. I think having it near our amazing infrastructure of arts, of parking infrastructure, you know, we have on the riverfront and throughout downtown. We have a lot of parking infrastructure all over the city that's not used all the time, especially now that the nature of work has changed post-pandemic. We have a lot of great infrastructure. So why not value add to that. We have an incredible investment in the convention center that's happening now. And so whether the arena is near that or in another part of downtown or on the riverfront, having it in the core of the city, I think would be an important thing long term. And ultimately where it goes is way above my pay grade. As I keep saying that term. We're just, you know, architects who advise on things, but I think that it would be great to have it somewhere near the core of the city, just from a activity, a generation, all the infrastructure, all the roads lead, right? All roads lead downtown, right? The highways lead downtown.
Hotels. TQL Stadium kind of really, I mean, there was a big conversation. This mm-hmm. conversation happened around that stadium, mm-hmm. Oakley, Northern Kentucky, or the urban core. Mm-hmm. And really, I think there's a lot of discussion about good or bad, but it has done what they said that it would, like the infrastructure around it and all of the things and the people and the energy in that corner of our downtown.
It's amazing. It's a value add. It obviously contributes to Over the Rhine, some of the nightlife and, you know, and what Jeff and everybody at the club and Mr. Lindner and everybody has done there is incredible. I mean, I was there Saturday. It was electric. And then all those people spilled out. Well, not all 25,000 or 26,000 spilled into Over the Rhine. A good chunk did and added more business.
Or they were there beforehand.
Yeah. And I think it is a good example to say doing that kind of investment there versus the other MLS stadiums, the MLS teams that struggle are the teams that stadiums are not in the core of their downtown. I lived in Denver when they, for a few years, took a little break from MSA, just went out west. They had built where the Rapids play. They're lucky to get 15,000, and that's a bigger city because it's way out in the suburbs.
And Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City is far out, and everyone knows someone. I mean, that there are rivalry, and people know that stadium, and they're like, "Oh, it's a drive, and you have to tailgate and everything."
I took it for granted how cool it is to have our stadiums connected to downtown until I, you know, like went to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. For the, you know, I was at USA Today at the time and the convention was there, the presidential convention.
And they have all the stadiums on the south side of that big sea of parking, right?
Yeah, it's like it's disconnected from downtown. And there's two stadiums like way off to the side in the middle of just like an open parking area. It's just,
well, you know what
soulless.
They're doing there now, right? They've proposed they're coming back and building an urban district around those stadiums.
Yeah.
And so we already have an urban district. So why wouldn't we take this large multi-purpose venue, much like these other two here and TQL, and insert that energy around our existing urban district that you can't build that today? I mean, our architecture and our downtown is magical compared to most places. So why wouldn't we put that investment near the center city?
So circling back to the question I asked about what would you do if you were king for the arena? On a more practical sense, everything you talked about, you need the vision and the purpose of the Sports Authority. Mm-hmm. Are you able to fulfill that vision without addressing the arena, or is there enough here that can be kind of backburnered?
I think the arena is an issue of its own, but I still think having the Sports Authority is going to be critical, just for all sorts, because not every event needs an arena. Right. But I think.
But are you handcuffed a little bit without a competitive, you know, compared to our peer markets and, you know, why, you know, who do we lose concerts to? Who do we lose NCAA basketball tournaments to?
Yeah. I mean, I think Julie could probably really and the CVB could talk about that. I think the sport, if you took the infrastructure we have now, let's say take the arena off the table. And just say Heritage Bank is what it is. I know there's doing some minor improvements now. I think the Sports Authority has a place already with what we have between the two large stadiums on the riverfront, between all our college. You think we have a lot of college facilities, and they are great partners on our World Cup bid. A lot of our local universities were going to be the training sites for these teams. And we were partnering actively with NKU, Mount St. Joe, UC, and Xavier were some of the training sites. And so there's a real collaborative spirit in the region, which has been interesting to watch through the World Cup, where I got engaged pretty heavily as part of that committee. There's a lot of collaborative spirit already. So just to have a core group full time, their job is to sell the region on these sporting and activities and recreation and whatever these events are related to sports and sports tourism, I think is going to be critical to have a core professional staff who does that work has advisory boards and professional advisors from the corporate and business community and the nonprofit community. Having them here with what we have now is already going to be a win-win. And so the arena, when and if and however that conversation plays itself out, when it comes into the mix, if a new or renovated arena comes into play, that's just a value add. And it certainly would probably change the kinds of events, but there's a lot of events that don't need an arena of that size and scale that could certainly be pursued now. And I think it's going to be nothing but positive for the region once it gets up and running.
So I'm going to ask you the most important question. Are you ready?
Right. You want me to dodge it or you know, I'll answer it.
Could we ever get the Savannah Bananas here then if we have a sports authority?
They just played Fenway. They just did Fenway.
All right. So that's on the table. They could come here.
I would leave it to the smarter and wiser people in the CVB, but I think we have the venues that could support the Savannah Bananas, whether it's on the river or whether it's over in Northern Kentucky. I mean, we've got, you know, there's a lot of venues here for baseball, and Cincinnati's a baseball
town. Hey, you
heard
it here first. It's a possibility.
All right. Sherry's just desperately trying to get you to break some news. I didn't know you'd go the Savannah Banana route. But
I wish.
If you're on TikTok, you follow Savannah Banana.
I would say I have no authority on whether they're coming, but I would say we have the places that could accommodate them. How does that sound? Is that a good answer?
When I was at spring training, Sherry, I was shocked because, you know, a lot of the businesses around Goodyear cater to people coming in to watch baseball. Mm-hmm. And so you can go into these stores and find, you know, Cactus League team gear, Reds and all of that.
Yeah.
And then a whole wall would be devoted to the Savannah Bananas. That's how big they are becoming in the culture. Like,
it's interesting. I grew up with the Harlem Globetrotters, right? I remember seeing them when I was a little kid at St. John Arena in Columbus when it was the original guys, you know, Curly and all those back in the 70s.
Isn't that funny how, like, that era of the Globetrotters, you could name them, you know, Curly O'Neill, or I forget his name, but Meadowlark Lemon, right?
Yeah.
Name a
picture
Harlem Globetrotter
head,
today.
No.
You can't do it.
But they are that on an amazing scale. And I think it's been great for baseball. I think it's been really good for baseball for them to do what they've done to invigorate, you know, a unique kind of entertainment energy around the sport. Because you want to see baseball succeed. You want to see soccer and baseball and obviously hockey and football. But I think it's been really good for baseball just to have that entertainment going around the country to interest people and young kids in the sport.
Young kids and get them, the entry point.
Yeah. And the pitching clock, which I think has been great, but that's a whole nother.
Well, let's go down that rabbit hole.
We don't have time. No. Otherwise, I would say yes, because it is.
Well, I just need to go on the record again. I'm a big fan of the pitching clock. I do not like starting a runner on second base in extra innings. I think that's cheap.
Who are we just talking about this with? One of our guests.
And the fact it's called a ghost runner. If you've played cul-de-sac wiffle ball, you know what a ghost runner is. You've earned that runner. Someone actually hit the ball to get out there, but they have to bat again, so you have a ghost runner. You don't get a freebie runner, but we digress. We digress.
All right. Well, you know, we have run a little long, and we really appreciate you stopping by today.
Happy to do it.
I learned a lot. All right. And I will be appointing you king for a day somehow, maybe in a story.
You don't need that. Nope. There's other wiser, more talented people who can do that.
This is all fascinating. This is the stuff that a lot of us geek out over, just the whole, you know. And I'm fascinated by the people. You're a little more than behind the scenes, but just the people who are at the table, you know, having these conversations and thinking big. So if that's the message you bring.
Think big, Cincinnati.
Yeah.
It's okay to sell ourselves beyond ourselves, because I think there's a lot here in this region, in this city. There's so much to offer America that I believe Cincinnati and I'm not a native Cincinnatian, although I'm raising three native Cincinnatians now. I think they're beginning to see it's a great town. It's a great place to live. There's so much to do here, and it's, you know, it's easy to become a part of the community, which I think it embraces you. If you want to get involved, this city will embrace you with open arms. If you say, I want to help, they'll let you come in.
All right. Well, what? I can't think of a better note to end on.
Yeah. Think big.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, I suspect I'm going to be talking to Bill about a lot of stories coming up. Exciting stories.
Bill's one of those guys that is quietly involved in a lot of things happening here just by nature of, you know, his experience, where he works, his passion. What passion? I mean, that's what came through. I love when our guests are passionate about what they're involved in. And man, he is like capital P passion.
So. I know. I love how he came to his do his career.
Yeah. No, good story. Good guess, Sherry.
Okay.
Good, good, good. All right. Well, do you have a Cincinnati moment to share?
You know, I have been a couple of weeks ago, out of the blue, I did something kind of different. And I feel like it was a Cincinnati moment. One of my friends is really, the older we get, for birthdays, experiences, not things. And I support this and I think it's a good idea. But I was like, well, what could be a good experience that we could do for her birthday? That's a gift. And we ended up deciding to take a cooking class at Turner Farms in Indian Hill. It's like a 501c3 kind of like charitable farm. But of course, they like sell things. It's a working farm. It is just absolutely beautiful there. They actually have two like, wedding event spaces. It's gorgeous up there. But they have like programs where you can, you know, participate in a produce share, pick your own produce if, you know, if you live close to there, which I don't. So it was kind of a drive to go up there or, you know, pick your own flowers.
Do they let people from Delhi into Indian
Hill?
Did you need like a passport?
No.
Or anyone from the West Side?
But we took a cooking class in one of their event spaces and we just really had a great night. Now, it's not the kind of cooking class where I'm now going to become like a chef over at Jeff Ruby's. We did cook filet. But I got some good recipes and we just had a lot of fun. We met great people because then you end up having, you eat what you make and had a communal meal. We met some interesting people from all around the area and we just sat and talked and it was such a good friend experience, but date night, most people there were for like a date night
to do
something kind of different.
Cool. But
they welcome people during the day just to come walk around. You take your kids. There's a lot of learning opportunities.
Yeah.
There's like a farm stand there. Okay. So I would do it again for sure.
I'm down with that. Sounds great. And you know what? We have also kind of shifted into the experiences are more important than stuff, which I think is a cool like phase of life to be in.
Yes,
like,
you spend time together.
Yes. Well, that's a great moment, Sherry. So, I don't really have anything
like a hidden gem
to compare other than, you know, we had the family golf tournament, the family mini golf tournament.
Intriguing.
Yes.
We've been doing it
for a few years. Well, we have a traveling trophy.
Okay. Yeah. You do this every year?
We do. Okay. Yeah, we've done it for the past 3 or 4 years. I think 4 years. We usually have it around my brother's birthday, which is in May, but we kept having to delay it. I lost the trophy last year to my sister.
Okay, I've met your sister.
Yeah. And then my brother-in-law took the trophy this year.
Everybody really competitive?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah. So we've written a story about this place before. It used to be Edder's golf facility on Reading Road in Evendale. And this guy named Todd bought it, and they've turned it into a place called The Acres. Thank you, Phil. I had a senior
kind
moment,
of
Sherry.
Silent Phil.
Yes, thank you, Phil. The Acres.
Where's it at?
It's right on Reading Road.
Okay.
In Evendale, very close to where Formica is headquartered. It's very accessible off of 75.
Does it have like the kind of mini golf that's like windmill, like then a pirate ship?
No, it's not that. It's not that like over the top crazy stuff. But it's a fun mini golf course. But they have a big driving range there. And what they also did was they kind of refurbished the buildings there, and they've got great food. I would go there just to eat, you know. And it's just a great low-key place to hang out with the family.
We might have to do that. The Coolidge boys are trying to get me to take up golfing because they both love to golf.
So,
Alex is trying to woo me with the outfits. And I was like, I just don't think I'm a golfer. He's like, but the outfits. And that has not even convinced me yet.
It hasn't even convinced you? Well, so what you
but
can
maybe
do...
maybe we could all do this together.
So what you can do is go to the Acres, hit a few buckets of balls, a few buckets of balls, you know, and then end up with, you know, 18 holes of mini golf.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you fared well enough, though?
That I Oh, yeah.
You didn't embarrass yourself
Lauren. No, not at all.
Was it everyone for themselves or were you like in families?
Oh, it was everyone for themselves. Okay. Yeah. We keep score, you know. I joked with the owner there because he handed us the scorecards and the pencils. The mini golf or the golf pencils he has erasers on them.
Oh, no.
That is not good for my family because it just makes cheating easier. So we are all like looking over each other's shoulder when, you know, people were keeping score and all of that. No, we're good. But yeah, my brother-in-law, basically, you know, it's par three each hole. He strung together a series of twos, like one under par, a couple holes in one, you know, didn't have the meltdown. Most of us that were like in contention had one bad hole. You know, there's some twisty, curvy, rampy things, you know, and if you, you know, if you played mini golf, you know, you can like go conservative and on those holes and maybe get a three. But if you like try to shoot it over the ramp, go all or nothing, you know, that could be like a hole in one or a two, or like then you're on the wrong side of the slope and you're hitting it like six times to get up there. So
I might go find out about this. Wait, there's an important question.
What's that?
Do they serve ice cream?
I do not know.
Okay.
I've not gotten the ice cream there. You know, they got great burgers, great, like, you know, it's just a...
To me, I don't know, just from like my youth of like mini golfing.
Mini golf,
it's like mini golf kind of goes hand in hand with like soft serve ice cream.
But I tell you what, since we're talking the Cincinnati moments, if you are at the Acres, you are just a few miles away from the Creamy Whip at Vonderhaar's.
Okay.
It's called Don's Creamy Whip.
Okay.
It's, again, right off Reading
notes?
Road.
I feel like I should. You know what? I'll have the transcript of this later. We're okay.
Yes, Don's Creamy Whip. Highly recommend.
Okay.
So that's what you could do, Sherry. You could do a night out in Evendale / Reading.
Okay.
And you could hit two iconic places.
I will leave you with this one little kind of that's a Cincinnati little quickie.
Yeah.
The Coolidge's tonight. Jack asked to do this last night and he said that he wanted to go out for ice cream and we just really couldn't do it last night. But tonight we are going to walk to UDF and we are going to use the free ice cream cones we all got on our phones from when we went to the baseball game for Jim Borgman. For your previous guest.
Right.
And somebody hit something. I don't know, a double or a triple.
A triple.
And it came up on a screen.
If a Reds player hits a triple, you get a triple scoop at UDF.
That is what we are doing tonight. And I am getting peach.
Oh, that sounds good.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yes. I love those promotions. You know, it started with the, if a Reds pitcher strikes out 11, everybody gets free pizza from La Rosa's.
Okay.
And now, you know, UDF is like, okay, well, we'll do better than that. If someone hits a triple, you get a triple scoop. So
we're using it tonight.
So since we're talking
about Alex, because I was like, yeah, we could go to Grader's.
So since we're talking about
ice cream. No, we have free ice cream.
and Phil, you're going to have to weigh in on this too. When you go to the Creamy Whip.
Okay.
And you get those things, those little teeny things that you like put on top of
Jimmies.
They're sprinkles. Phil's nodding.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. That's a big debate in our family, too. Are they Jimmies or sprinkles?
Okay, that's probably where you come from.
I bet it is a regional thing.
Like tennis shoes or sneakers, like soda, pop or soda.
Pop or soda, yeah.
Okay.
So you go for the Jimmies.
Me and Phil go
for the sprinkles.
Okay, on vanilla. You got on vanilla?
No. The one that's twisty, like the chocolate and the vanilla.
Okay.
It's the swirl.
Oh.
Yeah. No, right. The order at Don's is the swirl with the sprinkles.
You know what we need to do?
They have all the dips, too. They have like 100,000 dips. You get like a peanut butter dip, a cherry dip, you know.
We need to have an ice cream-themed podcast. I actually have an idea. We'll talk about it after.
All right. Well, on that note, enjoy your Jimmies tonight.
Okay.
And we'll see everybody next week.